The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is the novelist and playwright Michael Frayn, who joined us to discuss his 2002 novel, Spies. The book is set during the Second World War, as the elderly narrator Stephen Wheatley looks back on a summer in which everything changed for him. He and his best friend Keith play at being spies, imagining that German agents lurk around every corner. But when they begin following Keith's mother, secrets emerge that neither can fully understand. It's a mystery, a war story, and a coming-of-age narrative. Book Club host John Mullen began by asking how the novel came about.
The beginnings of this book are autobiographical. For years, I wanted to write something about my childhood, or something to do with my childhood. I couldn't quite put my hand on what the story was. And I thought about it. I began thinking about it because I made a film for BBC television about the suburbs of London. And because I wanted to make it a very detailed examination of why the suburbs look the way they do, I focused it on the three streets in which I grew up. And it started me thinking about the suburbs in general and my childhood in particular. But it took me a long time, I think about 11 years, in fact, before I first got a thread, before the first idea of how to do it. I suddenly remembered that I had a great friend when I was about 11 years old, and we played pretend games together. And I suddenly remember that somewhere in the middle of the Second World War, he said to me, absolutely out of the blue, "My mother is a German spy." And I realized this was, we were starting another game. I realized we were going to put on false beards and things and following his mother around. It was all going to be great fun. And I can't remember now what we did, but I think we followed his mother around for a couple of hours. And in that time, she didn't steal plans for any new aircraft or get in touch with the German High Command. It all got very boring. We gave up. But I started to think, supposing we had followed around seriously for a couple of weeks, say, what would we have made as children of an adult's life? And I started to think, well, probably we'd have understood it in terms of what we knew about the world, in terms of the stories we'd read and heard. And that was the very beginning of the story. I should say that after that point, everything is entirely fictitious. But curiously, the book had an extraordinary follow-up. As I was, I drew on a various, although the story is fictitious, I drew on various characteristics of my friend's family, and his parents are very much as depicted in the novel, that's to say, a very kindly and charming and attractive mother, and an absolutely brutal father. And as I got near to finishing the book, it occurred to me for the first time that if I was still alive, as I was, it was possible my friend was still alive. I hadn't seen him since I was about 12 years old. And he sort of passed into myth in my memory. And I began to think, well, maybe he hasn't passed into myth. Maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's alive and he's going to read this book and he's going to be upset by what he reads. And I began to get rather uneasy. And out of the blue, as I finished the book, there came a letter from this old friend whom I hadn't seen since we were 12, 13 years old, saying, "You won't remember me," as people always say in letters, "but we used to play games together and we used to set up camps in the hedges around our houses from where we fought the Third Reich." And at the end, when he signed his name underneath, in case I still didn't remember who he was, he said, "The one with the terrible father." Well, of course, I had to write to him and go and see him, and I had to confess that I'd written this book in which I'd taken one or two characteristics from him and his family. And I had to show him the manuscript when it was finished. And he might well have said, look, I think this is a very nasty piece of work, and I find this very hurtful. And I don't know what I'd have done. I think I'd have had to put it on the shelf.
Because the character of the friend, Keith,
is
a, I mean, he's a nascent version of his dad.
He is.
He becomes more, actually, seems to me, very skillfully through the book, more and more he does his dad's smile. His smile is the most horrible thing his dad does, and all that old bean stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, anyway, fortunately, my friend read the book, and he was extremely generous about it. And what he liked most particularly was the portrait of his father.
So he had known all the time when you were friends what his father was like.
Oh, we both knew. Yes. His father used to cane him, and he, on one occasion, would have caned me had my friend not nobly stepped forward and accepted the blame for what I'd done, which was just put my hand on some fresh paintwork.
Because the father in the novel is an extraordinary character, is very, very threatening, but in a way that is much less clearly seen than it sounds like you saw what this man was like, this father of your friend. But in the novel, it emerges, you know, the nastiest things about him become the fact that he's always whistling, and that he has these odd endearments that he called. And then there's
very cold, isn't he? Very cold to his son, and as it turns out, worse than cold to his wife.
Yeah. I mean, that's when you're describing that, how you transplanted the sort of brief scenario from your own childhood into this. I was wondering about also the sense of period, apart from the fact that it fits your own memories. I mean, I'm always tempted to say, when I'm thinking about why novels might be set in the 1940s in particular, 30s, 50s as well a bit, but particularly the 1940s, is that you can somehow believe all the more strongly that this world of apparently absolute reticence and propriety must harbour some nasty secrets. So that, I mean, do you think that's true, or do you think this would work for any given period?
Well, I think you can make it work for any given period, but this particular story does depend on the fact that this country was at war with Germany at the time, and everyone was obsessed with finding German agents. When I talked about the book in America, I was astonished to find that some people in the audience remember looking for German spies in St. Louis, Missouri, and places like that, even before Germany came into the war. So I think it's very much of the story that it's set in that particular period. Also, it was for us in the outer suburbs of London, it was a particularly nice time to grow up. At a time when millions of people were having the most horrific experiences, including people in the centre of London who were being really badly bombed. In the outer suburbs, the bombing was extremely infrequent and just bad enough to produce a few nice bomb sites that you could turn into playgrounds. And because there was no traffic on the roads, and because all the psychopaths were away in the army killing somebody else, we were allowed to go where we like, and we had an extremely free and easy time. I can't believe, looking back on it now, how free we were to do anything. No one worried about it.
And it's not a self-portrait, obviously, in any psychological sense, but the narrator of the novel, Stephen, is... you do this thing which other novelists have done occasionally in the past, which is that a small episode in his life takes up almost the whole book, and then other things in his life, two marriages, children, a whole life actually, which one I think surmises was eventually quite happy and fulfilled, is mentioned in passing. And I'm just thinking about what kind of character he is, and he says something about himself as a character. But maybe this also makes him, tell me what you think, a certain kind of narrator, which is he's got this line, which, of course, I with embarrassment when I read it. You know, you've made your own children say it. I have, I'm afraid, so often. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. That's kind of one of the sort of great, you know, it's like, it's one of those phrases, like one of those absolutely disingenuous things, like with the greatest possible respect or something like that. If you say it, it can't be true. Thank you for having me. And that's his sort of... he says it right at the end of the novel, actually, doesn't he?
I think he does. It's so long ago since I read it.
He does.
I can't remember
quite
what goes on in this book. But I think he does. Yeah. But I think not disingenuously. I think that's what he does feel about his life, as I rather feel about mine. I'd like to thank all the people who have put up with me and
he also says that it's when he uses the line earlier about himself, he also says I've always been an adjutant to somebody else, I've always been a disciple. And he makes even his occupation as a translator, technical translator, not the same kind of translation you do at all, a kind of metaphor for the kind of person he is, that he's sort of an invisible conduit or something between one person and another. Isn't that...
Yes, well, but that's purely autobiographical. I have always been an adjutant to somebody else. I have always depended on somebody else as a child and as a student, depended on somebody else's imagination. There was always some charismatic figure to whom I was a kind of lieutenant. I did with this particular boy... As a child, he thought up all the games, so he had the best part in all the games, and I kind of hung around admiringly and tried to follow his invention. And maybe I've been overcompensating for that since by writing stories and plays, writing fictions, in which I controlled the story, in which I told the story. I wasn't waiting for some friend of mine to do it for me.
Well, you make it, it's emphasised in Spies by an extraordinary thing you do, which I can't think of any other example, but perhaps people in the audience will think of one, where the narrator talks of himself, especially in the early parts of the book, a lot in the third person, and when he talks of his younger self. There was an example I came across a couple of years ago, a novel by Damon Galgut, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I can't remember what it's called now, where he does it. But he does it in an autobiographical way because it's very autobiographical. So he sometimes calls himself Damon to remind you that it's actually him, the author, in the novel. But your narrator does it about his younger self. And it has a sort of extraordinary... There he is, this sort of teapot-eared... youngster. Why that stylistically was quite an unusual thing. Why did you make that decision?
Well, two reasons. One, isn't it what we all feel when we look back on ourselves as children? We feel some connection with the way we were, but we also surely feel, most of us, well, unless everyone feels completely different from me, that they're looking at some third party, someone who is not... The child, what I was like as a child is not what I'm like now, and I do feel quite bemused looking back on what I was like as a child. Of course there's a thread of connection, and there are things I can remember of what I experienced then, things that I sympathise with. But I think everyone feels that. But I also did it for a technical reason. It was quite a difficult story to tell. And we need to know two things in the story. We need to know what the boy in the story thinks he's seeing in front of his eyes, what he makes of those events. But we also need to know enough about an objective view of those events to see that as readers, we don't necessarily accept his viewpoint. It's a kind of a detective story. In the traditional detective story, you have a very smart detective like Sherlock Holmes, a very stupid reader. And the stupid reader thinks, God, what a smart guy. You know, he knows he can see the answer, which I can't. And in this, it's the other way around, because the reader is smarter than the little boy. The reader can see that there are explanations for what the little boy is experiencing that the little boy can't understand. But I hope in the end you feel... that maybe the as a reader didn't quite get it right yourself, that the explanation is slightly odder than you thought.
We've got a travelling mic, which we need for the podcast and for your sort of Hollywood-type appearance, if you're going to ask a question. So who would like to ask?
I just wanted to ask, one of the things that comes up, I've been teaching the novel for 4 years, so I hear this time and again, and one of the things that comes up a lot is that the dominant protagonist, I mean the main character, Stephen, is so silent throughout the novel. And I mean, he talks, I think it comes up in connection with Bob's, with his own parents, with Barbara. I say nothing over and again. And I wondered why you've got such a silent major protagonist.
It hadn't occurred to me he was particularly silent. He has a reasonable amount of dialogue, doesn't he? But perhaps not as much. Well, he is dominated by his friend, and it's his friend who has the ideas. He does attempt to give his friend explanations of what he's doing, and attempts to think of similarly fantastic ideas to his friend. They were dismissed by his friend, but he does. We're talking about Stephen, the central guy. Yeah, he says a reasonable amount. One of the things about the novel is, I hope, it's about the terrible contradictory pressures under which children find themselves. On the one hand, they're supposed to tell the truth. On the other hand, they must never, ever tell the truth about friends that might get them into trouble. They're supposed to do well at school, but they're not supposed to look as if they're doing well at school, and so on.
In chapter 10...
I warned you about
this. No, really. Chemnitz, Leipzig, Zwickau, if those names were ever spoken, another name might jump out after them, a name that would shame Keith forever. I don't know what that name is, but perhaps you could tell us. But in pursuit of this, I Googled the book, and I came upon an extremely entertaining thread for AS-level students helping each other with the essays they were writing. And I wondered if you'd read it and liked it, because somebody on it is masquerading as you, or maybe is you, and what it's like to have a book that you've written being an A-level text.
Well, to start with the end of the question, I was told by teachers it's a very popular choice as an A-level text, but then they explained it because it was the shortest book on the list. I have slightly mixed feelings about it being an A-level text. I remember... the difficulty I found in answering exam questions about books, even books I particularly liked and particularly admired, and I wouldn't like to have to answer questions about this one. But I didn't quite understand your question about the name. Would you?
Yeah, Chemnitz,
Leipzig, Zwickau. If those names were ever spoken, another name might jump out after them, a name that would shame Keith forever, a name that I've never allowed myself to think.
That's the this is the names on the map.
This is the names on the map.
Yeah.
But what's the name?
Tell me the page. Tell me the page.
It's page 192 on the first edition.
All right.
Well, I think it's Keith's mother is talking about, isn't it? How about Paige? Who wrote this book? Oh no! It's the name of Peter. He's talking about Uncle Peter, isn't he? And how his Keith's mother is having some kind of affair with him. I think I'll find it very difficult to remember. God, I better rewrite this book.
So, if those names are ever spoken, another name might jump out of them. Out after them. That's Peter's name.
Peter's name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Someone in the RAF who'd been involved in owning an escape map, I guess.
Greg Brooks, I lived even more of my childhood in Yule than you did. In fact, all of it, in my case. So, having seen Three Streets in the Country and read the book, I knew exactly where you had set it and could see that. So... and indeed emailed you about it, but that's another matter.
Did I reply? I hope I replied.
You did, yes. Yeah. You said great detective work. So, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the autobiographical bit of that, if I may neologize, about how you reimagined that bit of East Yule for the novel And then, in particular, whether you went and haunted the close where you lived when you were writing it.
I don't think I went back to look at it when I was researching the novel, as far as I can remember. But, of course, I did when I was making the film, because we had to actually stand there and do it. And I made a lot of interesting discoveries making the film. We accept it when you're a child. That's the world. You don't queer it. Things are just as they are in front of your eyes, and there's no particular reason why they should be like that. But one of the things, if you go back and research things, is you find there are historical reasons why things look the way they do. And one of the things that really worked in the film is I discovered that if you look at the suburbs, they look just absolutely arbitrary street shapes. But often those street shapes have been determined by quite ancient historical reasons. And I discovered that the three streets in which I'd grown up were in this odd triangle because it was a piece of land which had become available when it ceased to be farming land, and they were that shape because they'd been part of the estate of Nonsuch Palace, and the main road had taken a great detour around the park. And we had a very good bit in the film where we had a helicopter shot, and the helicopter started very tight on these streets and pulled out gradually to reveal their shape, and then it dissolved into a map of the old field shapes in the district. So I discovered that. But in order to write the novel, I had to change the relationships of things to things and put things closer together and make things slightly more dramatic. After I'd written the novel, I went back to look at the tunnel, which figures very strongly in it, and discovered it's not very low at all, and it's perfectly clean and dry ground underneath. But I've clearly remembered it as being absolutely a horrible, slimy, wet, and damp place. But I think I was running it together with another tunnel, which was just outside Yulee Station.
That's correct. It's much nearer to Yulee Station, absolutely, that one. Yes. Yes.
Anyway, so things did get a bit fictionalized.
Gentleman at the front.
Perhaps one thing aspect we haven't touched on is Stephen's growing sort of sexual awareness in the novel, and also obviously mirrored by the sexual behaviour of Keith's mother and so on. And I detect a sort of fondness between Keith and Stephen and Keith's mother and so on. I mean, I wonder if you could say something about that. What was your thinking there? I mean, was that, presumably that wasn't strictly autobiographical, it was done intentionally as a part of the novel to say something to us?
It wasn't directly autobiographical, but I certainly remember that dawning feeling of interest in girls. And I've said in My Father's Fortune that everything about girls seemed to suddenly be magical. The fact that they wore dresses, the fact that they had these wonderful names like Wendy and Deirdre and Jean and so forth, and the fact that they had longer hair than boys, and the fact they ran in such a funny way, and just the fact that they were girls. It also absolutely sort of dissolved in their presence. And indeed, one girl in particular. So I was trying to catch something about that, and it's forever indelibly associated in my mind. This is entirely autobiographical, with the smell of privet. I don't know why.
But oh, exactly. So that is a kind of Freudian something.
Every June, it's about the third week of June, the privet comes out, and every year it comes out. In spite of having written about it in the book, you might think would have got it out of my system. I absolutely go weak at the knees. I remember, remember the intensity and the unfocusedness of this feeling as a child.
But Keith's mother is a very sort of, by dint of her reticence, is a very strong character in the book, isn't she? And sort of
yes. Well, I think one, at that age, one does start to become conscious of the attractiveness of the opposite sex in general, girls of one's own age, but also begin to see that adult women share something of that same quality.
Yes, can you hand it to the... Thank you.
I have to confess here to a tremendous feeling that you had captured my life when you wrote that book. I could have been Keith, an only child with a glamorous mother. Fortunately, I didn't have the same sort of father. But the right age and the right place. I was actually at Hinchley Wood, which was very similar to your Yule setting. And like you were just saying a moment ago, the road we were in followed the track of an existing track that led from Thameslink to Claygate. Yeah. And the top of our road dissolved into the original track, which was overgrown. We didn't lead to the labouring houses with the dogs and the children and so forth that we had in the book, but there was at least one ruined cottage in the woods up there. But I must come to the point. It really comes close to what you were just saying a moment ago, and that was, in my own experience, there was also a Barbara Beryl around from whom I learnt a thing or two. We won't go into that, but I just wondered how close you got to the Barbara Beryl.
Well, starting at the beginning, Hinchley Wood, if you ever read My Father's Fortune, you'll discover that when in fact when I had another friend later, when I was 15 or 16, with whom I discovered music and poetry together, we used to go and sit up an oak tree on Surbiton Golf Course, which is kind of been far from where you were, and read each other our extremely long poems. 500 lines, 1,000 lines, whatever. And this was before we realised that poetry was metrical. So St. Hinchley Wood and its and the neighbourhood came into my life later on. There wasn't anyone exactly like Barbara Beryl in my life, but there was a girl, indeed she comes into My Father's Fortune again, on whom I particularly focused my my feelings. But there's also other people came into the story, people I'd, you could focus your feelings on people you never met. In My Father's Fortune, I've explained how the doodlebug landed on the district and just shattered all the roofs of the houses. And a crew of tilers came down the street to retile the roofs. And one of them was an American who was not in, young American who was not in the army because he had bad feet and wore plimsolls. And we all absolutely fell in love with him. And one of the things we loved most about him was that on his shirt he had stitched, embroidered, the words Stella, Chicago, 1943. And I was so in love with Stella and Chicago.
Is it, lady?
Could we afford some sympathy for Keith's father? It very forcibly struck me that I was trying to work out his age. Is he an older father and therefore was in the First World War and possibly injured, and therefore his reaction to that in a way is a juxtaposition to the way that Peter reacted to his trauma in the Second World War. And well, I didn't want to just dismiss him as an ogre. He was an awful man, obviously, but...
That's an extremely interesting idea, the two of parallel. I must admit, I hadn't thought of that. But I only know what Stephen knows, which is what he sees in front of his eyes. And I think you're absolutely right, he's plainly an older father. And he's plainly too old to do military service in the Second War. Whether there's any truth in his son's stories about how he killed all those that many Germans with a bayonet in the First World War, I think it's very unlikely. But I suppose he probably has fought in the First World War and done something.
Because we are supposed, aren't we? I mean, I take it to support what the lady was saying. We're to take it that that's true, isn't it? That he has fought in the First World War, even if he tells tall tales about it. Well, and if he tells tall tales about it, perhaps actually something awful did happen rather than something brave and glorious and
Well, I don't know whether you're supposed to do this or supposed to do that as a reader. It seems to me quite likely that he has, yes, from everything we find out about it. But whether he had a traumatic experience or whether he's just a horrible man anyway, I don't know.
I'm really interested in the comedic aspect of the novel, especially the really, really funny moments when Stephen develops as a person. For example, when he smokes the cigarettes with Barbara Beryl, and when he encounters the wetness of the flap of her purse and stuff like that. All these weird comedic moments. For you, is it to sort of escape the tragedy of what's happening, for example, with Bob's? Is it sort of a moment of comic relief, or was it more a moment of accentuating the realism of childhood? You know, that just it appears hilarious to more adult readers.
Well, it seems to me that some things in life are funny and some things aren't funny and some things are puzzling and some are obvious, and that should all be reflected in a story. And it seems that was just the experience of that character. I didn't put things in for a particular reason, but because they seemed to be, they just came as part of the story. As to adopt the explanation that John kindly gave me earlier, it was a gift from God. I don't know why he reacted in that particular way. He just did. It's a ridiculous thing to say, and I know it sounds sentimental, and people hate writers saying it. But you do feel that the characters, once you get going, the characters do begin to speak themselves and do begin to feel and think themselves. That's just how it's seen. And of course, you try and debate the matter with them and try and persuade them to play the plot you've written for them. But it does feel as if they have their own presence, and they find them feeling this and thinking that and having such and such experiences.
So you don't agree the Vladimir Nabokov line, my characters are my galley slaves. You don't, that's not how you see it.
Well, not galley slaves, but they are collaborators in a kind of way. And my latest novel called Skios begins with someone coming arriving at an airport and looking at all the people holding up names, and going up to someone whose name does not belong to him and saying that he is that person. Well, I've often thought of doing that myself. Every time I've arrived at an airport, I thought, what if I went up to that person? He obviously doesn't know what I look like, or he wouldn't be holding up he doesn't know what his customer looks like, because he wouldn't be holding up a sign, and say, I'm so-and-so. How far would I get? What would happen? Well, I haven't got the courage to do it, unfortunately. But one of the nice things about writing fiction is you have all these assistants who've got the courage to go out and shoot people, commit murder and bank robberies and whatnot, or tell people that they're people there, tell drivers that they're people they're not. So it's a kind of collaborative process. I wouldn't say quite galley slaves. But,
well, perhaps with the wonderful confession that for Michael, fiction is a kind of enactment of suppressed personal desires, and that his characters are behaving in ways that he wouldn't dare to himself. Maybe it's a good time to bring it to an end. Michael will sign some books afterwards, if that's okay. If anybody, I'm going to manoeuvre him over to a table at the back there, anybody who'd like a book signed. And I'd just like to thank all of you for coming and for all your questions, and of course to thank Michael for talking to us.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.